listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
Desiree LeBeau is a Stanford pediatrician and infectious disease researcher who has dedicated her efforts to better understanding the risk factors and long-term health consequences of arboviral infections. Among the diseases she focuses on is Zika and its possible link to microcephaly, a birth defect in which infants are born with unusually small heads and incomplete brain development. Dr. LeBeau will be speaking at the second annual Child X Symposium, a conference focused on inspiring innovation in pediatric and maternal health, taking place April 21 and 22 at Stanford. Dr. LeBeau is a clinical associate professor of pediatric infectious diseases at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, Stanford. Desiree LeBeau, thank you for joining me in One to One.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with you and I were just speaking before we started about where are we with the knowledge of, first of all, the link between Zika and microcephaly? Because there have been a lot of questions early on. Was there a link? And now you've just told me the link is really hardening.
Yeah, so more and more evidence is accruing that Zika does seem to be causing microcephaly. That was always the problem. It seemed that it was just associated with microcephaly and there was no causal link. And of course, it's difficult to really prove causality, but more and more evidence is mounting that it looks like it is in the causal pathway. There's been data showing that neural crest progenitor cells are actually the ones that are at risk for having Zika infection. So that's just kind of, again, showing the link between, you know, developing neural brain cells and the neurotropism of this virus.
And the progenitor cells are a key to the development of their neurological development.
Right,
In utero.
Right, it's what will become, the nervous system. And also, there's been more and more evidence that's actually looked at the babies that have suffered Zika infection in utero. And there was one paper that was published in the New England Journal that really solidified things for me, just showing that there was more virus detected in the brain of that fetus than anywhere else in the baby. And they actually had electron micrographs of the virus actually in the brain tissue. And then you could see just the damage done to that baby's brain.
We understand now the link between Zika and microcephaly. How does that move this along?
Right. So, there was so much back and forth early on. Maybe it was a cofactor, maybe it was pesticides, maybe it was, you know, this or that. And so I think now that we know that this virus actually really does cross the placenta, causing congenital infections that result in very severe deformations and malformations of babies' brains, I think people are much more willing to put forth the effort, you know, both the resources and the time to really find either cures or vaccines or that sort of thing to prevent this infection from damaging any more babies.
And the epicenter is still in Brazil. How large is it growing?
I think at this point, I think there's about 2 million cases, if I'm not mistaken.
So really
yeah,
large,
yeah,
really
getting larger and larger all throughout Central and South America. And so it's very difficult. When you're in outbreak situations, you know, the health system's overwhelmed, the public is frantic. But I think in this particular outbreak, I think people are actually doing a very good job of trying to do some good epidemiologic research on the ground as it's happening, much like we got forced to do with Ebola. It was the same sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, the CDC is really working hard to get some, you know, good data about, you know, we don't know the denominator, right? And we know it looks like Zika is causing microcephaly, but we don't know how often it happens. Are there periods of pregnancy that are more at risk for Zika virus infection? If you're symptomatic with your Zika virus infection, does that mean, you know, what percent of the time will your baby actually be infected? If you're asymptomatic, can you still spread it to your baby? And so on. And more investigators out there in Brazil and the U.S. and in other countries are really trying to investigate Zika on the ground. Colombia's got a study right now where they're looking at all cases of pregnancy and following them to see, you know, what is the incidence of Zika malformations and so forth. And more evidence is mounting. Initially, as a pediatrician, I thought that, like many congenital infections, if you get the infection in your first trimester, that, you know, that's when everything's really developing, and so probably things would be more severe then. But a recent paper that was published actually showed that there were even severe brain malformation cases of Zika acquired in third trimester. So first, second, and third trimester, there were cases in each of those that actually had bad outcomes. So it's making us really rethink, you know, what is going on here.
And how significant, what do we know about microcephaly here in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. So infants? Microcephaly is a rare birth defect. There are many different causes of microcephaly. Some of them are infectious. Many of them are genetic, right? But some of them are infectious. And the poster child for a virus that causes microcephaly is CMV, the cytomegalovirus. And so that's a very, very common virus. I mean, supposedly, you know, it's 1% of babies born have been exposed to CMV. So it's really, really common.
So we don't have any indication yet that there are infants born in the U.S. that have microcephaly because of Zika.
There was, I think, one case in Texas where a woman had traveled to Brazil during her pregnancy, but she was Texan, and then the baby was born and had microcephaly. But there haven't been any locally acquired cases of Zika in the continental U.S. Of course, it's going on in Puerto Rico right now, but nothing in the continental U.S.
The preparations and the concern and the warnings, how would you put them into perspective about this encroaching as we move into the summer months, as we move into the human months in the southeast, southwest? What are the preparations? What is the sort of the threat?
So we here in the United States do have the vectors that support Zika transmission. We have Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus mosquitoes. The habitats for those mosquitoes in the continental U.S. extend, like you said, really in the southeast is where they're mainly concentrated.
Humidity.
Right. But we do have pockets. Even in California here, we have had both Aedes albopictus and Aedes aegypti documented in California.
Mosquitoes,
which are the vectors. They are the species of mosquito that are the vector for Zika virus, and also dengue and chikungunya. So I think what's going to happen in the U.S. is going to look a lot like what's gone on with dengue and chikungunya, which are other mosquito-borne viral infections. And what's happened there is that we get a few sporadic, locally transmitted cases in the Gulf states, Florida, Texas, and so forth. And usually, because we have very good mosquito control associations here, we kind of quell those outbreaks quite quickly, and there aren't large numbers of people that get exposed or get sick with the infections. But I think just like those infections, we will have locally acquired cases, a few in Florida and Texas, perhaps Hawaii, and so forth.
Why is the mosquito such a powerful vector for the transmission of these sort of diseases?
So I'm an arboviologist, and there's lots of different mosquitoes that spread these different different viruses. But for Zika, what we're talking about is Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus mosquitoes. And the Aedes aegypti, or the yellow
Aedes
fever.
Aedes aegypti.
The Aedes aegypti mosquito, which is also the yellow fever mosquito, spreads. It spreads dengue, it spreads chikungunya, it spreads yellow fever, it spreads Zika. And this mosquito is such an efficient transmitter of disease for a few important reasons. So the first is that it's sort of a homebody mosquito. So it likes to live in and around human habitation. It likes to preferentially feed on humans, and it feeds in the day and it feeds in the evening. So it feeds all different times. The other thing about this mosquito is that it likes to preferentially lay its eggs in man-made containers. So we call them container breeders. They love to lay their eggs in flower pots, flower dishes, dog containers, trash. It only takes about a tablespoon of water to allow efficient egg laying or overproduction. And then finally, this mosquito is sort of a nervous Nelly. So say it bites a person and it gets infected with Zika or dengue or chik, whichever one you want to talk about. And then it goes on to there has to be a period of time where the mosquito then becomes infectious. So it goes through the midgut, and then it goes back to the salivary glands, and then the mosquito is able to transmit that virus to an uninfected person. But when this mosquito feeds, it'll start to bite you, but then if you move a little bit or the wind blows, it comes right off. And it takes about 4 to 5 individual people that it has to feed on in order to get enough blood to have a sufficient amount of blood to actually lay its eggs. Right. And so that means it could have transmitted disease to 4 or 5 individuals. And so that's a little bit different. And that, I think, is another reason why it's such an efficient vector for these diseases.
And what is the life of that?
So it differs a little bit in different climates. And vector ecology, you know, there haven't been a lot of studies of this vector all over the world and how long it lives. We think it lives a few months. We think it takes a couple weeks for it to become infectious. But, you know, all those details and all the different climates and how the world is changing, I'm not sure we fully understand it all.
Doesn't Zika underscore the connectedness of the world and how we have to prepare so much, so differently today for health crises and pandemics than in the past? We're a connected world.
Absolutely. So I think one of the reasons why we keep seeing these infections emerge, just like chikungunya is still emerging through the Americas and dengue's outbreaks all over the place.
Talk about chikungunya for a minute. What is it?
Okay, so chikungunya is another mosquito-borne viral infection spread by Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus. It is an infection that can actually lead to very long-term health consequences because 40 to 50% of people who get infected will have long-term arthritis from it. Mm. So it actually isn't a very important economically and for human health reasons. And so chikungunya has been endemic in Africa and all throughout Southeast Asia for quite a while. But recently, it's been emerging. And so in 2004, 2005, it swept down the east coast of Africa into the Indian Ocean islands, where vacationing European travelers got sick. And then they started to study it. They brought it back with them and started thinking, oh, God, chikungunya, this is a horrible disease. Why haven't we heard about this? Then it went to India, where it had been many, many times before. But they noticed that the outbreak seemed worse. People were actually dying from chikungunya, which they hadn't seen in previous outbreaks. And then the virus went from India into Europe, where it was responsible for large outbreaks in Italy, autochthonous outbreaks or locally transmitted outbreaks. And since then, it spread in France and other nations in Europe. And then from there, chik from Asia actually got introduced into the Americas in 2013 when it was first noticed in Martinique in the Caribbean. And just like Zika is spreading with the epicenter being Brazil, the Caribbean was the epicenter, and it spread from the Caribbean all throughout Central and South America. And it's still spreading today with, again, about 2 million cases of chik. And we now know that maybe the virus changed a little bit and made it able to actually efficiently transmit in Aedes albopictus mosquitoes, not just Aedes aegypti mosquitoes. And that's how it got into South Europe, because there's tons of Aedes albopictus in South Europe. And so I think what Zika and chikungunya and a lot of these different outbreaks, I mean, we've seen a resurgence and emergence of these outbreaks over the last 20 years. And, you know, they're thought to be due to viruses that we thought we had under control, like dengue or yellow fever, viruses that expanded their geographical distribution, like when West Nile came here, or when Rift Valley fever spread into the Middle East, or Zika or chikungunya now in the Americas. And I think it has a lot to do with urbanization and a lot of sort of influence of modern life. So we live in a more urban world now. So there's many more people. They're clustered together. They're impoverished in a lot of places. And so that, again, allows for vector habitat. We change our world, right? So there's deforestation, reforestation, land reclamation projects, which allow for vector habitats to grow. We have a lot of, unfortunately, military activity and war, which stops any kind of surveillance or control that was going on that leads to it. And then we have all the climate effects, climate change, warming, extreme weather events like El Nino, which helped to initiate outbreaks of diseases like Rift Valley fever, which are dependent on floodwater Aedes to initiate outbreaks. And then finally, what you bring up is we have increased globalization or transportation. And so you can get anywhere within the world within 24 hours. And so can these viruses. Usually they come with us when we get sick with them, or sometimes we're not even sick with them. We have no symptoms. And so we're on a plane traveling across the world. And if the vector exists in that new place we land, there's an opportunity there for transmission to start.
Which is like Zika, because many people are asymptomatic, right?
80%.
80% of people are asymptomatic and never come down with any illness, et cetera.
Right.
Now, trace Zika. Zika, I understand, has been around since 1940s or so.
Right. So it started in 1947. So we name arboviruses after the places where they were first discovered. So West Nile was discovered in the West Nile District in Uganda. Zika was discovered in the Zika Forest of Uganda in 1947. It was actually when they were doing yellow fever research. And they had a colony of monkeys, and they were trying to get the monkeys to get yellow fever. And a monkey came down with the sickness, but it wasn't yellow fever, which is what they were looking for. It was Zika. And so they didn't know if it was important for human health, but the monkey got sick with it. Fine. And so then there were sporadic cases throughout Africa, no more than really like a handful of noted cases. Now, I work in Kenya, and I know that sometimes in impoverished areas, these sort of infections go unnoticed or misdiagnosed and so forth. So who knows how much Zika was a problem there. But what happened was it went into Asia, and then from Asia, the first big outbreak was in 2007 in Yap Island. And that's when I first heard about Zika. About 70% of the population had been affected. And this was
Where's the Yap Island?
So Yap Island is an island in Micronesia.
Mm-hmm.
And so
How did it migrate to Yap Island?
Yeah, I think it's just movement of people. Mm-hmm. And again, because the vector is everywhere in the sort of tropical world and expanding, if you bring it in and the vectors happen to bite you, you can start little outbreaks. And if you get sick enough or you have enough virus in your bloodstream to then infect other vectors, which you can with Zika or dengue or chik, then other vectors can get infected. And when you have a susceptible population, no one's actually seen the infection, then you can have a large outbreak. So in Yap in 2007, there was that outbreak, and that made the news because 70% of the population got infected. It spread like wildfire. And then from Yap, it went on to French Polynesia, and there were outbreaks there in 2013, 2014, which were quite large again. And so that's Zika got more attention then, and then it went to Easter Island in 2014, and then hit Brazil May of 2015, and then it spread from Brazil all throughout Central and South America and the Caribbean.
Why are some people so susceptible to these viruses and others are not?
So that I would love to answer that question. That's what I want my life's work to be, to understand the spectrum of human disease with these infections. Some people are completely asymptomatic. Other people actually die from some of these infections, and there's everything in between. Some people are more at risk for neurologic disease. Some people, can have other types of severe manifestations of these different viruses. And so I think some of it has to do with maybe how much virus or the way that you get your virus, depending on which virus we're talking about. So inoculum and sort of route of transmission. And then some of it has got to do with host immunogenetics, right? Mm-hmm. How our body sees the infection and how we respond to the infection.
And what state your body is in when you are infected.
Exactly. Comorbidities, general health, so forth, age. I mean, there's so many different things. And so we're trying to understand that. And I think with Zika, one of the questions was whether prior dengue infection could either make Zika better or make it worse, right? And we don't know yet what the answer. There was a study done that was published in The Lancet maybe a month or so ago, where they were investigating Guillain-Barré, which is another bad complication of Zika virus infections, and many, of course, viral infections like influenza, of course, has been linked to Guillain-Barré, Campylobacter, many, many different infections have been linked to Guillain-Barré. But they were trying to see if what the risk factors were. Were people with Zika really more likely to get Guillain-Barré? And it was true that people with Zika were more likely to get Guillain-Barré, but they didn't see a difference in people who had been prior exposed to dengue. So.
You mentioned global climate change. And mm-hmm. What do we know about how global climate change is actually impacting these viruses?
I think more work, of course, needs to be done in that area. It's easy for me to say that the world is warming. Mosquitoes do like it up to a certain point. They like it warmer. Temperature can change the number of days it takes for that mosquito to become infectious, 6-10 incubation period. So it can actually, instead of it being 2 weeks from when the mosquito gets its infected blood meal to when it actually becomes a transmitter of disease, that can shrink down to 1 week, depending on temperature and different environmental variables. So I think the environment actually has direct effects on the vector pathogen or virus interaction in that way. But then, of course, I think that a warming world makes it more likely that a mosquito is going to be able to survive there. And I think that's been seen in different areas, because the area where you can start to get vector-borne diseases is climbing up mountains, right? The altitude at which you can get these things now is a lot higher than it used to be. And so I think in those ways, it just kind of expands the region where these vectors can live and breed and then cause disease.
And I would think also the more droughts we have around the world, the more that people are getting containers of water and storage of water and keeping water. And those are habitats, as you said earlier, for mosquitoes.
Absolutely. And that's another way this is happening. So there's actually been work done by one of my collaborators and colleagues. His name's Asaf Onyamba, and he's at NASA and USRA. And he has actually done modeling to link up chikungunya and dengue outbreaks and drought. So it's exactly what you say. You know, for other infections that I study, like Rift Valley fever virus, because that virus is linked with flooding. First, the flooding happens, and then the initiation outbreak happens. The more rain you have, the more likely you are to have Rift. But with dengue and chik, it's the exact opposite, and it all comes down to the vector behavior. Because they are container breeders that like to really breed preferentially in man-made containers. When there's drought, people are worried about their water security. They try and hold as much water as they possibly can because they don't know when they're going to see water again. Often these containers are not safe. They're open, and therefore they allow the mosquitoes to come in and use them as a breeding habitat. And that, of course, increases the disease risk.
What are some of the most significant control strategies that are taking place to prevent these infections right now? What is Brazil doing? What do you see spreading across Latin America, South America to take these on?
So really what we're left with, there's no treatment, right? There's no vaccine at this point. There's no drug cures, nothing like that. So we're really left with vector control.
And let me stop you for a minute there. And where would you say we are in terms of a vaccine?
So I think the work is just beginning. Because, you know, Zika is a flavivirus like dengue, we have dengue vaccines that are in, you know, phase 3 trials. And so dengue vaccines are forthcoming. And I think we can be quicker about using that technology, a related flavivirus, and putting in Zika virus proteins, kind of substituting them in and seeing if we get the same effect. So mm-hmm. I think it will be quicker, but I think it's still some years away mm-hmm. for sure. And then drugs, people are working on, you know, small molecules, all these different types of potential drugs for these viruses. We have a very limited arsenal when it comes to antivirals in this country or anywhere in the world, unless it's HIV. And so we definitely need antivirals for many, many viruses. As a clinician, I can say that for sure.
And how much has been ramped up in the last months, 2 months, 3 months in the NIH to look at all the strategies of control?
Well, I know that, I mean, Obama asked Congress for $1.8 billion, 900 and I think 70 million of it supposedly is going to CDC, and another couple hundred million are going to go to the NIH for vaccine development and so forth. So I'm sure there are many scientists that are out there that are working on vaccines and working on treatments. Back to your question about vector control, I would say, you know, right now what we've got is vector control. So there's the vector control at the immature stages. So that's the egg, you know, the larvae, the pupae before the mosquitoes emerge and can fly. And then there's adult vector control. And so, you know, there are different techniques. There's the chemicals, always new chemicals that we're trying to find that we can use as larvicides and so forth, or adulticides. And then there's human behavior, right? So you have to try to avoid getting bitten by a mosquito, or in the case of Zika, because some of it can be sexually transmitted, although that isn't as important as a mosquito control. You know, you have to change your behavior, and so that can be difficult.
And you've said with other outbreaks that active ongoing surveillance is critical, and that it is critical also to respond within the first few weeks of an infection and knowing that. So how do we intervene
right
early on?
We have to be doing surveillance to find it. So that's the tricky part, right? Surveillance doesn't seem like something anyone really wants to fund or send resources to. Why should we survey for something that may never be here? You know, but actually it's actually quite important, because if you delay the just knowing that you have this thing spreading in your community, you're going to be behind the eight ball, sort of. Mm-hmm. And it's going to end up leading to exponential costs as far as human health costs and just dollars in trying to quell an outbreak. It's much easier to prevent things when you have a smaller pocket, right? Either spatially or when you're just dealing with fewer mosquitoes earlier in the season, or, you know, so I think surveillance is really where we need to spend a lot of money. It's, again, it's not very sexy or exciting, but we really have to survey so that we know these things are spreading, so that we can really be proactive about preventing transmission. Because if we wait until there are tons of human cases and human outbreaks, the same reason why you asked me why are these such, you know, great vectors of disease, it's really hard to control them, right? I mean, a tablespoon of water, how are you going to find all those breeding sites? It's nearly impossible.
And talk about the surveillance. What exactly is persistent, significant surveillance?
Yeah, so right now, I mean, I work with the Mosquito Control Association up here that's in Burlingame, and you know, they go out and they actually look for this species, for Aedes aegypti. You know, they trap. They actually set out traps and look for the vector. And if they find them, then they go out and they spray, they adulticide, they try to larvicide, they do what they can to try and decrease the numbers, right? And so, and they do the same for West Nile, right? They're constantly looking for West Nile all across the country because that's like our main really endemic arbovirus. And so they take, that's a different mosquito. It's the Culex mosquito. But again, they're trapping using traps that are more preferentially attractive to these Culex mosquitoes. And so they get them and then they test them for virus to see if any of them are infected. And if they're infected, they go out and they serve, you know, they spray and they do what they can for vector control. I sometimes get those phone calls. We're going to be spraying in your neighborhood. And they must have found a positive West Nile mosquito in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's what it takes. But unfortunately, that takes a lot of resources, right? And so even here in this country, we have problems continually trying to support vector control and surveillance. And several years back, I think it was 2009 or so, Obama was going to cut all the pretty much the vector-borne disease budget out of the CDC budget. And we weren't going to have any more vector control and surveillance. And luckily, he put it back in, but he put it under emerging infections. And so emerging infections can mean a lot of things more than vector control and surveillance. So there was a huge cut, actually, in this country. And so, and across the world in impoverished nations, you know, you have a lot of competing interests that have a lot to do with human health. And you have other things you have to worry about. And so sometimes vector control and surveillance is at the bottom of your list. And now we see what happens.
The result of that.
Yeah, unfortunately.
How can new technology assist in efforts to stem these threats?
I think there's lots of places for innovation. So, again, as a person who's been studying these viruses for more than a decade, I'm excited by the opportunity that Zika is giving us because we're going to have a lot of different people who are going to be working on thinking creatively about solutions to this problem. I think that there can be new technologies in the way that we survey, again, for these mosquitoes, the way that we control them. You know, there's technologies like RIDDLE technologies and it's the genetically modified mosquito technologies, you know, to try and decrease mosquito numbers. I think we need new technology when it comes to diagnosing these problems. We, you know, there's all this cross reactivity between these related viruses. So if you have a person and you can't find the virus in them, it's very difficult to tell, well, did they really have Zika? Did they have, you know, dengue, or did they have yellow fever or some other flavivirus? And so I think new technologies when it comes to diagnostics and making those sort of field deployable diagnostics where they're much closer to the patient, where you have a quick answer, it's accurate, it's rapid, and you can do it right at the bedside. I think that's going to be very important, especially moving forward with Zika, because it's even hard to figure out who's been exposed and who hasn't. And then finally, I think there's an opportunity for new technologies in both the treatment and the prevention as far as vaccine goes.
You mentioned your work in Kenya. What exactly are you doing in Kenya?
So we study mosquito-borne viral infections and look at the incidence and prevalence of those infections in children to see how much of febrile disease is caused by these infections in Kenya.
Malaria.
So we look at, malaria is a parasitic infection. And so many people still think that if you have a fever and you're in Africa, it's malaria until proven otherwise. And so we are studying malaria, but we're studying dengue and chikungunya along with malaria to see how much is really malaria, how much is dengue, how much is chikungunya. And then we follow the children up to see what the long-term health outcomes are. We also, in that study, also trap the vectors at all life stages and look at ties of vector abundance and mosquito infection rate with human health risk. And we collect environmental information to see if we can somehow link all of this data together to sort of predict hot spots of transmission or seasonality of outbreaks and those sorts of things.
Hey, where was your work? Is it mostly in Nairobi? Is it outside of Nairobi in the bush?
Right. So we work in 4 sites in Kenya. We work in 2 sites on the coast, Musambweni, which is close to the Tanzania border, and then Akunda, which is an urban area. And then we work in Kisumu on the west side of Kenya, which is the 3rd largest city in Kenya after Nairobi and Mombasa. And then we work in Chulaimbo, which is a rural area out in the west. So we have 2 rural sites and 2 urban sites, 2 coast, 2 west. And we're trying to understand, you know, are people more at risk in the urban sites, the rural sites? How are the mosquitoes behaving? We're actually finding a lot of differences in the way that these vectors behave in Kenya than what's been published previously. They're outside more often than inside. So a lot of the data on vector ecology of these and vector biology of these Aedes aegypti mosquitoes are actually look like they're different than what's been shown in South America and so forth.
What brought you to this work? What brought you to this research? How did you get there?
Right. So I was pediatric infectious disease fellowship. So I had done my pediatric residency, and then I wanted to do my fellowship in infectious disease. And early on in my infectious disease fellowship, those first couple months, I really wanted to find a research project that sort of integrated my interests in global health and then sort of also sort of ecology, I guess. And so what ended up happening is I was at Case Western Reserve University, and I went and interviewed with all of the different principal investigators there. And there was a man by the name of Charles King who became my mentor, and he was actually a schistosomiasis expert. And he worked in Kenya, but he actually had a side project that was funded through the NIH to look at something called Rift Valley fever and the epidemiology of Rift Valley fever. And so I kind of really liked this. I thought I had liked viruses. It was in Africa, and it's very ecologically driven because it, again, is spread by mosquitoes. It's another arbovirus. And so I started working on Rift in 2003, and then I just have never stopped.
What does a conference like Child X mean for you?
I think it's going to be great. It's going to be all of these different experts and people who are really interested in child health from the beginning, from conception and on through the life, through the lifespan of the child. I think it's going to be a great collection of individuals, you know, talking in their different expertise, but really coming together to share ideas and see how we can sort of move child health forward. We still have a lot of work to do when it comes to protecting our children from diseases and improving their lives as they live them.
Desiree LeBeau, thank you for joining me in 1-to-1.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. 1-to-1 is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.